This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a roundtable discussion of the top stories in the news. Now, from CBS News headquarters in New York, here is senior correspondent Bill Lynch.
This past week, violence marred the Seattle gathering of the World Trade Organization. Northern Ireland entered a new era of Catholic-Protestant power sharing, and George W. Bush finally matched wits with his GOP rivals. To discuss these and other stories, we're joined by correspondents Mark Noller, David Dow, Bob Fuss, Kimberly Dozier, Jim Stewart, Dr. Emily Sine, CBS MarketWatch correspondent Stacy Tisdale, CBS News political director Dottie Lynch, and KIRO radio news director Steve Knight. The Seattle meeting of the World Trade Organization attracted tens of thousands of demonstrators, a few of whom battled police and caused lots of property damage. KIRO reporter Don Moyer was in the thick of it on Tuesday.
Chemicals have just been thrown by police. One of them hit a protester in the back of the head. One has just lit at my feet. I've gotten out of the smoke. The police department is trying to scatter the people. Some of the people who are protesting are grabbing the canisters and throwing them.
KIRO's Steve Knight, you covered the massive demonstrations and the attendant violence. Did those street battles take city officials by surprise?
Yes, they did. They admitted earlier in the week that they simply made mistakes in the way they planned to respond to the protests that they knew were coming. They let people get too close to the convention center, and they let the protesters get too close to each other.
And then they had to declare a state of emergency and widen their cordon sanitaire.
Indeed. And the reaction in the city was one of just outrage and disgust, frankly, by most of the people who live here, because we're not accustomed to having that sort of thing in the city of Seattle.
Now, these were some of the most violent demonstrations we've seen in this country since the Vietnam era. What will the cost be to the city in terms of property damage and such?
They estimate property damage now at several hundred thousand dollars. Probably the largest dollar loss is in the amount of money that the retail merchants downtown have lost. That's upwards now of $7 million, they think, because it's the Christmas shopping season. Our mayor is going to do something to try to make it up to people, to try to lure them downtown to keep shopping and that sort of thing. But the mayor, you know, late in the week acknowledged that had he known what would have happened, he wouldn't have had the World Trade Organization here.
Correspondent David Dow is also in Seattle. David, this obviously distracted attention from the meeting itself. What was the purpose of this gathering?
Well, the purpose of the World Trade Organization meeting was to, in effect, work out a blueprint for a new round of trade talks, global trade talks that would extend probably over the next 3 years. And as the week ended, they were pretty determined to stay on course for that. The delegates, however, had to do a bit of logistical jockeying after the first day of demonstrations, the largest day of demonstrations involving tens of thousands of people. And that, of course, got the conference off to a late start. It did eliminate the opening ceremony and set back the actual formal opening of the conference. But it should be noted that most of the work in these conferences, virtually all of the work in these conferences, takes place behind closed doors in negotiating groups involving knots of people. And that forged ahead on schedule.
President Clinton welcomed the delegates to Seattle, and he sought to ally himself with many of the peaceful protesters. Mark Noller, what was his objective in doing that?
Well, the president dismissed the violent protesters as vandals, but he said that he sympathized with the views of many of the peaceful protesters. And he, in his speech to the World Trade Organization trade ministers, he said, look, they have a point, the protesters, about opening up the process and about expanding trade, not at the expense of human rights, of labor standards, of the environment, and of impoverished nations.
Stacy Tisdale of MarketWatch is also with us. Stacy, we're, of course, in a globalized economy. What kinds of new rules need to be written to govern trade in the coming decades?
The very interesting thing to watch here is we saw the U.S. President Clinton kind of take a little bit of a sympathetic voice with the protesters in terms of the environment, in terms of labor. And the developing countries in particular were saying a lot of your environmental concerns, a lot of your labor concerns, we simply can't afford. You know, we can compete. We can get in this global economy because we have cheap labor, because we have these other things. I think the laws that you going to have to see come out, the rules that you're going to have to see come out, have to take into consideration that the U.S.'s views, the U.S.'s objectives might not be realistic in some of the less wealthy nations.
David Dow, of course, this is just the start of a process that could take years, the Seattle Round, so-called. What's the U.S. objective here?
Well, the U.S. had several objectives going into this in several areas. One was in the area of agriculture, which was to set in motion a mechanism to pare down the farm subsidies of European nations, which are there to protect family farmers and to protect the tradition of agriculture in their countries. The U.S. also came into this hoping to introduce some kind of language, some kind of mechanism in there that would get the whole issue of labor standards and standards for workers out there on the table. That became a very tricky issue for the United States. And in addition, there was an effort of sorts to get the environment and environmental standards woven into the blueprint for trade that was worked out here. Those were among the standards. And another one that is sort of the issue now was to prevent to maintain electronic trade as a tariff-free area. That was a major objective of the U.S.
You mentioned the Europeans' interest in preserving the family farm. I was struck by hearing the European Union trade minister openly admit that one of the reasons they subsidize their farmers so heavily at a disadvantage to U.S. farmers is to maintain the charm of the countryside in Provence or in Tuscany. That's an interesting public policy concept.
Well, yes, it is. And of course, if you've ever traveled through the European countryside, as I know you have, why, those of us who are tourists can probably enjoy the fruits of that. But I'm not sure in the world of expanding agribusiness in this world that it holds a lot of water in the minds of those who control agriculture in the world right now.
We'll come back with more on the WTO gathering and the booming U.S. economy. The violence that marred the WTO meeting in Seattle was not only an embarrassment to the city, which says it won't want to have such a gathering back again, but also to the United States, Mark Noller. President Clinton must have been rather shaken by that.
Well, he tried to take it in stride. In the weeks in advance of the WTO gathering, the president said there will be lots of demonstrators. In fact, he said there will be more demonstrators in Seattle than he's seen during his 7 years as president. And it did take a toll. The president revealed that as he was waiting to address the WTO trade ministers, he was speaking with the director general of the World Trade Organization, Mike Moore, and they were watching a technician hold up a white handkerchief for TV cameras to set their lights at the speaker's podium. And the president said that Mike Moore said that could be the flag of the World Trade Organization, a flag of surrender. But it didn't come as bad as that, but it was certainly an embarrassment. The president denounced and condemned the violent demonstrators, but he said the peaceful ones did have a point.
The president was probably grateful that this Seattle meeting did not turn out to be a gathering of world leaders as he had initially wanted.
Well, that's right. The president did, in recent days, extend an invitation to a number of chiefs of state to join him in Seattle. None of them accepted it. The only one that thought about it, who didn't get an invitation, was Fidel Castro. But he said he didn't come because he thought his request for a visa would be turned down. The White House said after that no, if Castro had requested a visa, he would have gotten one.
David Dow, consumers, of course, will ultimately feel the impact of decisions that the WTO makes. But in terms of the average person, there probably won't be any immediate impact.
There certainly won't be. Even the rosiest picture of the process that will ensue from the week's conference has it as a three-year process, a labored three-year process of negotiations, trying to work out the fine print, the fine points of a new international trade agreement. In fact, 3 years may, as I say, be rosy in that the last round of negotiations lasted much longer than that and stemmed from a conference held in Uruguay in 1986, when the organization, the World Trade Organization, even had a different name.
Stacy, Wall Street seemed to take a big yawn to the goings-on in Seattle.
I'm going
to
echo David's sentiments on that. Nothing new really came out of this. If you know, the changes that we're going to see are going to be a long, drawn-out process. But also, Wall Street has really had a front-row seat to the benefits of globalization. We've seen U.S. companies reap huge profits over the past few years. That's really been one of the underpinnings of this bull market. Even though the rhetoric that we're hearing out of the Clinton administration is that they're going to be sympathetic to labor, that they want to be more sympathetic to the environment. If you look at their policies, they repealed Depression-era banking laws that were designed to protect consumers. They are very pro-industry. So Wall Street doesn't see much of a threat to the policies that U.S. companies want to have around the world because of the WTO or because of anything that may come of it.
Mark Nolte, the administration continues to tout the 20 million jobs created during the Clinton administration, but a lot of jobs have, in fact, gone across the border.
Yes, but the White House says that other jobs are created to take their place. The White House and the president himself says that expanding foreign trade is the only way to keep the economic boom in the United States going. And the president can't wait until February, the month in which the economic expansion will become the longest economic expansion in American history, and just wait for the ceremonies and celebrations that this administration has to mark that.
Back to Seattle and the demonstrations and the violence which marred this meeting. Steve Knight, is the man on the street mad at City Hall over this?
The man on the street is very upset at City Hall. I think it's important to remember in all of this that there is one effect of the meetings here in Seattle, and it happened in the streets. The protesters, when they came to town, said, we want to put the World Trade Organization and what it does on the front pages of the newspapers and on television all around the world so people know what this organization actually does. Obviously, they don't like it. But they succeeded in making this thing front page news, and you can be darn sure that the next time the World Trade Organization meets any place, it's going to get a lot more attention than it would have gotten had what happened in Seattle not happened.
Well, the U.S. economy continues to chug along mightily. On Friday, the unemployment numbers were even better than many analysts had expected, and the markets just took off like a rocket into new record territory. Stacy, is this a blip, or is it a further sign of investor confidence in the economy?
Everybody's just all smiles. I mean, the numbers, the employment numbers really were so much evidence that the economy continues to grow, key here, without inflation. That means that the Federal Reserve is not under any pressure to raise interest rates to wage a battle against inflation. That's great for the bull market. So you see strong economy, you see low growth. We're going to have the Y2K scenario past us soon, moving into the election season. Congress is on recess, which is always good news for Wall Street. Anything that could really derail this rally is way out of the forefront. So many of the analysts I'm talking to they're calling for, you know, Dow 13,000 next year, and very, very, very bullish attitudes out there right now.
And in terms of the presidential campaign upcoming, we heard a proposal this week from George W. Bush for a sort of across-the-board reduction in tax rates. He's the front runner. Wall Street must feel good about that.
That's another positive for the market. Even, you know, George W. Bush is the front runner. There's a perception that he would have very market-friendly policies. But even if you look on the Democratic side, if we see Al Gore continue Bill Clinton's legacy to the economy and to the markets, Wall Street's really seeing the political elections as a win-win situation here.
And Mark Noller, the White House is obviously touting these numbers as well. Any clouds on the horizon for the year 2000?
The White House doesn't see them. The White House is elated with these latest numbers. The president can boast that 20 million jobs have been created on his watch. The White House points out that that's more jobs that have been, that were created during both the Reagan and Bush administrations, and that's 12 years. So this administration just is beside itself with glee at the economic numbers.
We did see a couple of things in terms of company news that affects Seattle this week. Steve Knight, Frontier Airlines decided to end its long relationship with Boeing and order its next fleet of jetliners from Airbus of Europe. How did that go over in Seattle?
It barely got noticed, frankly. Boeing, you've got to remember, goes through these ups and downs quite frequently. And they are the world's largest, or the country's largest exporter. And they were watching these talks very, very closely because they are in a terribly difficult competitive situation with Airbus industry, which is subsidized in Europe.
Okay. Well, the World Trade Organization will meet somewhere next time, but I'm sure it won't be Seattle. Seattle will be grateful for that. Coming up, we'll have a look at Northern Ireland's troubles, which may now be history. The week just passed may go down as the beginning of the end of Northern Ireland's 30 years of shootings and bombings that have left some 3,600 people dead. Protestants and Roman Catholics tried to set aside ancient mistrust, and they got down to the business of sharing power in that disputed British province. Correspondent Kimberly Dozier joins us from Belfast. Is there a sort of a palpable feeling there, Kimberly, that a new era is beginning?
Well, the surprising thing is that everyone is holding back. That's the real feeling you get. I've spoken to both Protestants and Catholics, and they say that, look, they've cried wolf so many times before, or rather cried peace so many times. So many times they thought they were close to this that almost this week people weren't paying attention. Many people I talked to in the street said, oh, yeah, I know something's happening, but I haven't really been following it. Now, I did meet some Protestant hardliners, that's how they identified themselves, who said that they were watching closely and they were very upset about it.
Are they prepared to do anything violent about it, I guess is the question.
I did meet one man, at least, who said, well, we're not putting, I mean, the loyalist paramilitaries aren't putting their guns away, and we don't think the IRA is going to disarm. He kept slipping into the we form. Now, the thing that is up ahead that could derail this whole process is, will the IRA disarm by the end of January, or will it be well on its way? It has taken the first step by appointing a decommissioning negotiator. Decommissioning, of course, is the process of disarmament. That is the man who will work behind the scenes with British officials and the Northern Ireland Assembly officials about how the IRA will turn over its weapons. Now, the loyalist paramilitaries are supposed to be doing the same thing. The question is, if the largest Protestant Unionist Party, the Ulster Unionists, if they think by next February that it hasn't happened fast enough, they've threatened to pull out. That is what a lot of people here are waiting to see. They're waiting to see if it's going to hold together beyond next February.
Of course, disarmament requires having a baseline of knowing how many weapons and tons of explosives might be stashed away. When is that going to be agreed upon?
Well, that is being done behind the scenes, and that's very much on purpose. The Canadian General John de Chastelain, who's in charge of this disarmament process, you know, an outsider has been brought in to try to keep it neutral. He says he has a pretty good idea of from British intelligence of what both sides have, and he is meeting now behind the scenes to, you know, say, we know you have this many automatic weapons. We want them here by this time. But the thing that they're being very careful not to do is to make any side feel like their backs are against the wall. Time and time again, the paramilitaries have said, you have got to let us do this by choice. If we feel you're forcing us, we're pulling right out of this process. So that's why they're trying to keep it out of the media spotlight and basically not let anyone know what's going on until it's done.
A couple of remarkable things this week. The new education minister in the new cabinet is Martin McGuinness, who's a former IRA gunman.
Well, so they say. It's always a little question mark hanging over Martin McGuinness's head. He actually took the wrong seat on his first official assembly meeting, and he's become a real comedian, actually, ever since he's taken up this ministry post. As he sat in the wrong place, he said, oh, well, that's my first mistake, and everybody laughed. So the first meeting, actually, though, according to all participants, was very workmanlike. Amazing that these people who were just sworn enemies just a few years ago were able to sit down and talk about the business of governing Northern Ireland. The first things they tackled were apparently the budget and how to start funneling some of this great amount of investment that's come into the country since the peace process, how to start funneling that into services across the communities as a way to make sure that everyone has some of the dividends of the peace process.
And another remarkable moment came when the Irish Prime Minister, with a stroke of his pen, eliminated the Republic's claim to the counties of Northern Ireland.
It's amazing that they have been apart 78 years, about that, and the Irish Republic has now said, okay, Northern Ireland, you can stand on your own. Now, of course, things like foreign policy and defense are still being run by the Houses of Parliament, by the British government. But this was a big step for the Irish Republic. Some Protestants I've spoken to here believe that this is still a back door, that the Irish Republic hasn't really given up its claims, and they say that one day they want a united Ireland. We're sure of it. So that suspicion still very much exists. But the people you speak to in Dublin say they're happy to see Northern Ireland go its way. They hope it does well in economically, as the South has done, and that the whole region will just be lifted up that way and become part of the European Union.
Mark Noller at the White House, I guess there's a huge sense of gratification there and a feeling that maybe this, none of this would have happened, at least this soon, without the president's intervention and his dispatch of George Mitchell.
Well, that's right, Bill. The president very much wants to be associated with the latest implementation of the Good Friday Agreement. Even though he was in Seattle at the World Trade Organization, he made a statement that he thinks it is now possible to believe that the day of the gun and the bomb are in fact over. The White House also arranged for the president to give an interview with news media from Northern Ireland. He wants to be associated with it. He may even go to Northern Ireland before this month is out to offer personal congratulations and pledges of support from the United States for the full implementation of the Good Friday Agreement.
Kimberly Dozier, is that a fair assessment, that we might not be having this conversation if it hadn't been for the U.S. contribution?
That is certainly the way people seem to feel around here. The question I got time and time again in the streets was, when's Billy coming? People here really believe that Bill Clinton and George Mitchell, George Mitchell is a saint in Northern Ireland, especially among the Catholic community, but also among many Protestants I met. He said, that man just hung on and kept on going. He had more faith in us than we had in ourselves. And there's a real warmth for both men. And there's a real feeling that without them and without some of the major British players in the process, Prime Minister Tony Blair, the new Northern Ireland Secretary, Peter Mandelson, he inspired trust on both sides. All those people, they took it forward.
And assuming that this holds, is there going to be an economic payoff for Ulster?
There certainly already has been. Hundreds of millions of dollars of investment have poured in since the peace deal was signed. And you can see it around town. A cab driver was telling me, you know, before it used to be that the Protestants would control those factories over there. I'm looking across the river here at some major port factories, a steel factory. He said, but now look, there's the BT, the British Telecom building, and here's another one. That's a French company. They don't care if we're Protestant or Catholic. They're just hiring us on the basis of, can we do the job? And that's the key. The paramilitaries used to recruit among the great droves of unemployed here. Now those young men and young women are beginning to get jobs, and that is the thing that many people here think is going to preserve peace.
Thanks, Kimberly. In Belfast, Mark Noller at the White House. Next up, George W. Bush becomes a common contestant. For the first time in campaign 2000, the six remaining Republican presidential candidates appeared together at a Thursday evening forum in New Hampshire. Bob Fuss, what, if anything, did voters learn new about these candidates?
Well, I'm not sure there was a lot to new, but a lot of the voters haven't been paying attention, and as we get closer to the first contest, I think they're starting to. What was new in this debate, of course, was that George W. Bush, the front runner, the governor of Texas, took part. He had skipped two earlier debates, had come under some criticism, and more importantly than the criticism, had watched his poll numbers in New Hampshire drop to the point where John McCain poses a real threat in the New Hampshire primary, which takes place on the 1st of February. And so he decided to come, and he, of course, was the target. They all attacked him, with the interesting exception of McCain. The other five really kind of pounced on him, and he kept his cool, defended himself, didn't really strike back. And basically, you know, he is in such a strong position as a candidate that what he had to do is not make any mistakes. What he had to do was show that he could answer the questions, that he could, get through the debate and not embarrass himself, and he certainly did that.
And in terms of McCain, was he presidential? We've heard all this about his temperament, and he, of course, addressed that to some extent.
Well, he did, and that was really very interesting. I mean, there are two separate issues here. One is the question of John McCain's temper. I mean, and he clearly has one, and everybody who's dealt with him knows he has one, and he's acknowledged that he has a temper, and he's certainly not the only political leader to have one. But there's also a sort of other question. There's a sort of whispering among some Senate Republicans that maybe it's more than that, that maybe he's just not quite stable enough. And he was asked about it very directly, and he handled it with humor, and he handled it pretty directly, and he handled it well. And I think, what's interesting is that he's somebody who is not well-liked by the other Republican senators, many of them, and the reason are the kind of things he talks about, and he did this in the debate. You know, he spoke about the need for campaign finance reform and about pork barrel spending in the budget and special interests. And the example he used, he said at one point that the example he used was almost criminal. And he talked about a huge ship that's being built for the Navy that the Navy doesn't want. And the ship is being built in Mississippi, and it's Senator Trent Lott, the Senate Republican leader, who's causing it to be built. And so, he sort of showed at the same time that he was defending himself against charges from other Republican senators, he displayed why it is they really don't like him.
CBS News political director Dottie Lynch, the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primary are fast approaching. Any sign that this could turn out to be the year of the maverick, like a McCain or a Bradley?
Well, it'll be interesting. New Hampshire likes mavericks, and both of them are doing very well in New Hampshire. They've picked up some ground in Iowa and in California as well, but still very much the front runner is George Bush on the Republican side and Al Gore on the Democratic side. But if they get some traction in these early states and voters decide that they want something new and different, they've got those choices on both parties.
Of course, that requires money and going past the first votes. How are Bradley and McCain going to be able to compete?
Bradley should be able to compete quite well. He's on a par with Gore in terms of money. George Bush has so outraised everyone. He and Steve Forbes both will be spending probably $40, $50 million for this. McCain is only in about the $10 million category. So it will be a disadvantage for McCain. But should he pull off a victory early, and that's what he's trying to do in New Hampshire and perhaps in South Carolina, he's hoping that what they call the free media, we call it the press, will carry his message for him, and it will be such a big Cinderella story that he won't need to rely on the paid advertising that the other candidates might have to do.
Thanks, Dottie. Checking in from the campaign trail, and Bob Fuss from Manchester, New Hampshire. Well, the violent Juarez, Mexico drug cartel is now believed responsible for the disappearance of more than 100 people, including some Americans. This past week, they began recovering bodies from a horse ranch in northern Mexico. Correspondent Jim Stewart, these mass burial sites apparently had been an open secret in that area, protected even by corrupt Mexican police.
Well, I don't know how open a secret it was, but certainly it was known among some law enforcement because it's been reported and confirmed that the source of the FBI on this was, in fact, a Mexican police officer who knew where the bodies were because, in fact, he had helped put some of them there. But these two sites are located on ranches just south of Juarez, and the interesting thing about them is that these people, and it's unknown how many are there, the FBI believes as many as 100, and Mexican authorities say there could be even more, but many of them were last seen in the company of people wearing uniforms. Now, whether these people were acting on behalf of the Mexican drug gangs or on their own is simply not known, and I think we're probably weeks away from knowing even the identities of some of these bodies they're beginning to bring up even now.
What time frame are we talking about in terms of these disappearances?
Well, the disappearances that are most commonly referred to as the narco disappeared in this area of Juarez and El Paso began turning up around 1995, 1994. Most recently, though, it's been the last 2 to 3 years that you've seen a surge in the number of people reporting that their loved ones have been simply disappeared in this area, and many of them, as I said, in the company of people wearing security police uniforms.
Well, we now have the FBI assisting the Mexican authorities in investigating this. That's got to be a delicate piece of partnership.
Oh, it certainly is. They negotiated for weeks whether FBI agents would be allowed to wear their uniforms, whether they'd be allowed to carry weapons, whether FBI helicopters could appear on the scene. The Mexicans obviously have a very great sense here of sovereignty, and it's a tremendous step for them to come to the FBI and ask for help. I think what it is, though, it's a signal that both sides realize that these gangs, I think it's wrong to call them gangs, frankly, they're armies, that's what they've turned out to, and there are five of them along the border there, and they are controlling the supply of drugs into this country and getting stronger literally every day.
And in terms of the investigation itself, I mean, if the police authorities are so deeply involved in narcotics activity, they're not going to want to be diligently investigated by the FBI, are they?
Well, you put your finger on it exactly. We've seen very few arrests so far. Mostly the people who've been were found at the site. Some of those have been taken into custody. But it's who do you go and point the finger at for pulling the trigger on the people they're going to find in these graves? And it is inevitable that at some point it's going to turn back to some of the Mexican federal police and state police who have long been known to be acting in concert with the drug cartels there, who are actually under the employment of these cartel gang leaders and who use the authorities to carry out vendettas and to send warnings. And so inevitably it would appear that some of the people in uniform are going to turn out to be suspects, and how that is going to play out will be very interesting to see.
And possibly some of their political overseers.
Well, that's been the history in Mexico for some time. That country is undergoing a radical change as they seek to become a nation of laws, something their president has promised to do.
Thanks, Jim Stewart, who broke this story this past week. Next up, new meaning for the Hippocratic admonition, first do no harm. The prestigious Institute of Medicine reported this past week that medical mistakes in hospitals cost as many as 98,000 lives per year. The report, entitled To Err Is Human, stressed that ways exist to prevent many mistakes by anticipating health workers' weaknesses and designing safeguards against them. Our medical correspondent, Dr. Emily Sine, joins us now. It struck me as interesting that not many healthcare professionals were particularly surprised by this, but a lot of consumers, patients were.
Well, what's interesting to me is that the statistics that this report is based on are actually quite old. What's new is that the Institute of Medicine is making very firm recommendations about things that should be done. For example, making it mandatory or voluntary to report mishaps or problems. Which right now, it's not mandatory or voluntary to do those things, something the airline industry has done so successfully to reduce accidents and problems with airlines, making them much more safer. The medical world is decades behind.
Of course, doctors are concerned about their liability if they report their mistakes.
Well, that's the very point. I mean, if you say you've done something wrong in medicine, you leave yourself open to litigation, and who wants that? So that you have to change the culture and the climate if anything like this would ever work.
Now, some other solutions include automating more of the process.
Computerizing things, especially when it comes to prescriptions, because about 7,000 deaths are attributed every year to prescription errors. That means either prescribing the wrong drug or dispensing the wrong drug. And look at everybody, we talk all the time about how bad doctors' handwriting is, how drug names sound alike and it's hard to distinguish, how, you know, 10 milligrams can look like 100 milligrams if you don't write it carefully. If these things are computerized, also interactions, if you computerize these things and utilize technology that's already readily available. You can drastically reduce prescription errors. That's been shown in places where they do have computerized prescription programs.
And things as simple as removing undiluted potassium chloride from patient care areas.
That's right. Stocking patient care areas with the right dosage so that you don't have these concentrated dosages that have to be diluted on the patient floors. Things like that, which actually are pretty simple when you break it down. It's just been such a difficult thing to get one's arms around because it's so varied and there's so many variables and multiples of people involved. To systematize it is going to take a while. It's not going to be an overnight thing.
So hopefully future studies will show fewer casualties through simple mistakes.
Yes.
Thanks, Emily Sine. Well, this week we salute an American original. 36-year-old Toni Merdin of Louisville, Kentucky, became the first woman and the first American to row across the Atlantic alone. She landed at the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe Friday morning, and CBS News correspondent Chris Glenn spoke with her a short while after she docked.
Hello, Ms. Merdin.
Hello.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful. Tell us, what was it like coming into port finally after 80 days?
It was terrific. Actually, the hardest part was that I've been able to see land for about 2 days. Being the purist that I am, I wanted to row all the way into port on my own and not take a tow. So I had to row past quite a lot of Guadeloupe. So it was tiring. I've been rowing. I rowed since 10 o'clock last night to be sure I'd be in on time to meet my friends.
What was the worst point of your journey? Any very disturbing experiences for you?
Well, I was right on schedule to beat the record for the fastest solo crossing, and then Hurricane Lenny appeared in the Caribbean and started moving in my direction and actually traveled 1,000 miles toward me, eventually passed directly over my position, but by that time it had pretty much blown itself out. It still had 80-mile-an-hour gusts when it went over, though, so it was a little daunting. And I went through a very bad hurricane last summer on my attempt to row across the North Atlantic, so I had some ghosts to do battle with.
How did you handle that? When you saw Lenny coming up and you thought about the one last year that tipped you over 15 times and you had to give it up?
It was terrifying. The difference, though, is when Lenny came through, Danielle last year, I didn't even consider setting off the distress beacon during the storm, but waited a day and a half until after the hurricane had passed to set off my distress beacon. Lenny wasn't nearly that violent. If I had gotten scared enough, I would have set off the beacon and had somebody come get me.
How did you deal with the loneliness of the long-distance rower, if you will?
I think I'm really fortunate in that I have a pretty fertile inner life and a lot of thoughts ticking around my head. So it's not terribly difficult for me as an individual, but I certainly missed friends and folks back home.
Now, you're a practicing lawyer in Louisville. What's happened to your practice since you left?
Actually, I don't practice as a lawyer. I work for the Muhammad Ali Center. Work for Muhammad and Lani Ali, trying to create a center that will honor the legacy of Muhammad.
Was there any type of fundraising involved for the center as the purpose of this trip?
No. Actually, I do a lot of fundraising on my own to finance the trip itself. But I hope to go back and take up my position at the center as the director of development.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. How was the trip financed? I mean, did you actively solicit before you left, or how did it go?
I had three major sponsors. Sector Sport Watches was my primary sponsor. They sponsored my trip attempt on the North Atlantic last summer. And then I had two sponsors from Louisville, Kentucky, Brown-Forman Corporation with their Fontana Candida wine line, and Fifth Third Bank.
We've already talked to some of your fans back home, and they are just thrilled and inspired. Are there any plans for any kind of a celebration when you return to Louisville?
I think I'm probably the last person who knows that information. At this point, I'm just putting one foot in front of the other.
What do you intend to have after 80 days at sea? Were you eating hardtack and salt pork all the time?
Well, I've had freeze-dried food for 3 months, and I'm going to have a fruit salad.
Any new seas left to conquer, so to speak? You got any plans for your next adventure?
No, I've been joking that I'd really like to go back to climbing mountains because it's a whole lot easier than rowing across oceans.
You climb mountains, too?
Well, yes.
Okay. Well, Tori, thank you very much for talking with us. It's a great pleasure to talk with you. And once again, thank you so much for accomplishing what you set out to do in such grand style.
Well, Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
And our thanks to Christopher Glenn, as well as to Mark Noller, David Dow, Stacy Tisdale, Bob Fuss, Kimberly Dozier, Jim Stewart, Dr. Emily Sine, Dottie Lynch, and KIRO Radio's Steve Knight. Please join us again next week for another roundup of the week's news. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News.
This has been the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Producers for the broadcast are Charles Kay and Michael Donahue. The associate producer is Michelle Cohen. The executive producer is Michael Friedman. This is the CBS Radio Network.